We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. A lot to cover, and starting with the election.
Yeah. For folks who haven't gotten them yet, your ballots should be arriving today. They were sent out a couple days ago. And there's a bunch of stuff this year. There's some very contested electoral offices, which we'll get to next week. But this week we want to start by taking a look at the ballot measures that are out this year. There's a few each for state, county, and local. So going down, I guess, in that order, we'll start with the state. And the first one is one that that I kind of have a different opinion on than a lot of progressives do. It is I-517, which is Tim Eymann's ballot initiative protection measure. And I think that's a yes vote, I need to explain that a little bit, because I think a lot of people say Tim Eymann, and they immediately go, "Oh my God, it's terrible," and vote against it just on general principle.
Because in addition, some of us looked at it like me. I looked at it and I said, "Well, this stuff is already, you know, law. Harassment is harassment, regardless of who the target is."
But that's actually probably the least important part of the initiative. So let me explain myself as the angry emails pour in. There's several other minor things, but there's three main portions to the ballot to that initiative. One is that it greatly extends to 6 months the period of time that organizations have to collect valid signatures, which has been a huge problem for grassroots initiatives of all kinds. In fact, Tim Eymann probably has an easier time doing that than most other initiative sponsors do, because he has deep-pocketed corporate sponsors who will help him hire paid signature gatherers. The second part of it is that it prevents, and probably the most important, is that it prevents local governments from keeping validly submitted initiatives off the ballot. And this has been a chronic problem for progressive initiatives as recently as the SeaTac initiative that we'll talk about a little bit later on around the minimum wage, which the Washington Restaurant Association and Alaska Airlines and some other industry groups actually sued to get off the ballot, and initially got the city of SeaTac to back down and keep it off the ballot. And again, if the initiative had itself had some access to lawyers through SEIU and so forth, they wouldn't have had the money to defend themselves in court, and that initiative would have been kept off the ballot. We saw this with the city of Seattle and the tunnel initiative a couple of years ago, where Richard Conlon and other people on council got the city to sue to try and keep that off the ballot. We tied it up in court for a while. That shot down a couple of initiatives against the stadiums in the 90s and so forth, that a lot of progressive initiatives have fallen victim to this as well. And then, as Maria says, the language of the signature gathering stuff around harassment and whatnot. Number one, it is already all law, so it doesn't really add anything. But the flip side of that is that, you know, the claims of some people that it will be used to keep people from challenging the lies told by signature gatherers. If you look at the language, it actually does confine itself pretty much to stuff that's already illegal. So pushing, shoving, yelling, spitting, stuff that, you know, if you're engaged in civil discourse, it shouldn't be an issue. And yeah, I guess signature gatherer can claim that illegal behavior is going on, but that can happen now too. So it doesn't really change anything there. And the other pieces of it, I think, are actually very good for anybody who engages in initiative gathering. And, you know, all other things being equal, we've seen how unresponsive city and state governments are in many cases to progressive measures, where an initiative really is the only way to get it into law. On the signature gathering, for example, we would have had marijuana legalization on the ballot a couple of years earlier if the initiative efforts that were attempted in 2010 and 2011 had had more time to gather signatures. So I think that's a yes, even if it is Tim Eymann. On the other hand, we also have on the ballot advisory votes number 3-7, which is a really, really unfortunate and also very hypocritical outcome of a previous Tim Eymann initiative. This is the one that requires advisory votes to the public anytime the state legislature raises taxes or revenues. And so we've got five of them on the ballot this time. They take up nine I can't say that word on the air, pages of the print voter's guide this time around. And I just have to wonder that, you know, Iman, who's primarily motivated as an anti-tax guy and not wanting to waste taxpayer money, how much taxpayer money was involved just in printing all those additional voter guide pages.
And adding to the ballot as and, well.
Yeah, exactly. You can either skip them because they are advisory votes and absolutely meaningless, or you can vote yes on all of them, just to tell the legislators that yes, this is a republic, not a democracy. We hire you to represent us. Now do your jobs.
as I read through them, yes, yes, close tax loopholes.
Yeah. But, you know, in a lot of cases, it doesn't even matter what the content of them are. But as it so happens, they all seem like pretty good ideas also. The other statewide initiative that's on the ballot is I-522, which we'll be talking about the campaign for that a little more shortly. That's the GMO labeling measure, and I think it's not particularly controversial on the show to say that should be a yes. You know, and again, there is no downside. It doesn't cost consumers anything, unlike the massive amounts of propaganda that's being put out by the no side.
Yes, and as the daughter of a dairy farmer, someone who grew up on a farm, I would like to say that I do support I-522 because it gives family farms a fighting chance against these big agribusiness corporations who use things like genetically modified organisms to drive us out of business.
Yeah, and I gather as an authentic farming person, you weren't asked to give the testimony.
No, and I was not paid to do that. Little commercial there either.
Yeah. And, you know, again, if you believe, the Monsantos of the world that all this stuff is so good and so revolutionary and so forth, they should want to advertise it on this food. So why do they object so much? Well, that's a good question. Moving down to this, the county, King County Charter Amendment number 1 would create a county department of public defense. That is because as a settlement of a class action lawsuit, the contractors that were hired through a nonprofit to be county defenders, are now county employees because they needed to get benefits, et cetera. But the reason they were separated out in the first place was to prevent conflicts of interest so that they couldn't have the political appointees or elected officials who were their supervisors trying to intervene in politically charged criminal cases. They need that layer of independence, and this would create that. So that's a very strong yes for King County Charter Amendment number 1. And there's also King County Proposition number 1, which is the Medic 1 levy. That, again, is a yes. It's an essential service by all accounts. King County does exceptionally well for the Medic 1 services that it provide. But there's the same caveat here that we have with things like the library levy and the parks levy and so forth, where you have all our education, where you have all of these essential services shuffled off into special levies so that politicians can slip their pet projects like corporate welfare for big developers or sports palaces or whatever into the general operating budget where people can't vote on them. So this shouldn't even be on the ballot. It should be part of the general operating fund. But that being said, it is on the ballot. It does need to be funded, so it's a yes vote. Seattle has a couple of amendments ballot measures. Charter Amendment number 19 is the district initiative. This would create 7 defined districts, and the boundaries have been defined based on the 2010 census. It would be redefined every 10 years based on census tract level data. And then 2 at-large seats would be retained. And the way that works out is that the people who would normally be up and the people who were elected for the first time this year would come up for vote again in 2 years, and then it would be staggered. So the other 4 would come up in 2017. And this is a yes, and it's a yes for the same reason that Seattle Proposition number 1, which is the publicly financed campaign, is a very qualified yes, and I'll get to that in a minute, which is that we have a city council in this city that is homogenous, that is in the pocket of big business, and that is completely unresponsive to the needs of most of the city. And this would make it easier for underfunded campaigns, grassroots campaigns, campaigns that are candidates that are based in a particular part of the city and can, you know, actually do the networking and the door knocking and everything else in 1/7 of the city that is impossible to do in a city of 630,000 people. Both of those would make it easier for people to run for office. You'd still have the incumbents would still have a tremendous advantage, but it at least makes it feasible as opposed to now when once you're on city council, it takes a lot to get you off city council again, and that's been to the city's detriment in a number of current cases. The qualifier for Seattle Prop Number 1, the publicly financed measures, is that the way city council wound up submitting this to the voters very much favors the incumbents. It requires 600 people donating $10 to $50 each in order to get on the ballot. And if that sounds like a lot, it is. Los Angeles, a similar measure, requires 200 at $5. When Seattle had this in the in the 1980s, 79 to 92, before the state legislature outlawed it, they had 300, and they've doubled that requirement, even though the number of people get this, donating to a campaign has not risen that much over the years. And, if you're an incumbent, you automatically get 300 to 400 discrete donors because of all the people who are doing business with the city who want to influence what's going on city council. So almost all incumbents qualify for this relatively easy. The Shama Sawant campaign right now, which is the most grassroots oriented campaign that's come along in a number of years, may just in the next week or two get to 600. That's really unusual. And the advocates for Prop 1 say, well, once this measure is in place, it requires, it incentivizes people to go after these numerous small donations. But it's not like campaigns like Sawant's aren't trying to do that right now.
How much time do you want candidates to spend fundraising versus actually talking about their positions and the issues?
That being said, it is still a public financing thing that will be put on the books. It's a lot easier to amend that requirement later than it is to get something brand new on the books. And right now, it's if you believe the latest King 5 poll, trailing rather badly. And that this measure has to do well, at least get close to pass, if not pass, or any other attempt at any kind of a public financing measure is going to be a long time in coming. Mm-hmm. So for those qualified reasons, I want a yes vote on it, even though it's already set up pretty much as an incumbent protection thing. And then finally, we don't normally cover suburban propositions, but we've got a major one in King County this month, and that is the SeaTac Proposition Number 1, which would, you've heard about it as a $15 minimum wage, but it also establishes paid sick leave, ensures that people can keep tips, servers, that it doesn't go into a pot that the house can keep, and so forth, and a number of other protections for workers. It really is basically a workers' bill of rights in a lot of ways. And because of that, there's been an enormous amount of industry opposition to it. We have, for example, the National Restaurant Association, which probably couldn't find SeaTac on a map if it tried, just donated $50,000. And this is in a city of 25,000 people to the No campaign. The Washington Restaurant Association already donated 60. They've gotten a number of other major corporate donors to the No campaign. And this not only that, but we had the Koch brothers got involved, too. The Freedom Foundation, which is one of their so-called independent think tanks, set out a report trying to undermine the initiative by accusing SEIU, which is the union that paid for the signature gathering, or coordinated for it anyway, of not paying its own workers $15 an hour. And there were two major problems with this. Number one, a union is not a business, so it would be exempted from the measure anyway. But secondly, and more importantly, they do pay $15 an hour. The reason the Freedom Foundation got its numbers is because what they did is they took SEIU's total tax line of payroll and divided it by the number of workers and worker hours in a year. So they didn't count part-time people. They didn't take into account temps.
Temporary workers.
Totally fallacious math. Which is the sort of thing that industries do when they don't want to pay their workers more. So a very, very strong yes.
Well, it's kind of interesting because as someone who works in the accounting department for a business and we provide accounting services to other businesses, we would never, ever try to calculate average wage that way. You have to take into account part-time workers and temps.
Yeah,
so it makes me wonder,
that's not an accidental error. Any accountant would know better.
That was an
intent to deceive.
Intentional lie.
All right,
and then we'll get to all the elected offices and public officials next week.
Next week.
Okay, moving on from there, the new rules are finally out for marijuana.
The State Liquor Control Board this week finally adopted the new rules for legal recreational marijuana use in Washington. Starting on November 18th, the state will license 334 retail stores in the state. 61 of those will be in King County, and 21 of those will be in the city of Seattle. But, of course, there's that opens up the question of whether that will be enough to meet the demand in a city, as Jav said, that has about 600,000 people. Seattle also has about 150 medical marijuana dispensaries currently, and more of them are opening every week. So that would point to the fact, that would point to 21 legal marijuana dispensaries as being far fewer than would be needed for a city of this size.
Yeah, what happened to the free market anyway?
I know. Well, the state has said it may expand the number, but of course they haven't given any particular rationale behind how they calculated the current limits. So I'm not so sure how quickly it will take them to ramp up. Much depends on much of the success of the new law depends on whether or not we can keep the black market down. And of course, if you limit the city to 21 retail outlets, you know, if people can't get their fix, you know, or people can't get pot, you know, when they want to have a party, they're going to be looking to a street source. So, I mean, imagine if, for example, you could only buy beer or wine in 21 outlets in the city of Seattle. That would be really tough, I think, for people come Friday night.
There'd be riots.
or Tuesday morning for some of us.
Yeah. Or any particular day for a few of us.
All right. Moving on, the study out in the 520 tolls?
Yeah, the U.S. Department of Transportation released a study this week on 520 tolls, and they found that the 520 tolls have cut commutes across the bridge approximately in half.
Which is something that anybody who takes 520 is already aware of. But
yeah.
More interesting was who isn't going now.
Yeah, 9 in 10 drivers who stopped using the bridge cited the tolls as the reason, and most of those are low-income drivers. About 60% of those folks are finding another way to cross the bridge, either via carpool or transit, and 45% of transit riders who cross 520 say that they chose to take the bus because of the tolls, and those people are primarily people who make less than $50,000 a year. For folks who make over $100,000 or over $200,000 a year, they are still driving across the bridge, and they are expressing a lot of satisfaction with the new tolls because, of course, it has cut down on their commute time.
Quite a bit, yeah.
So,
all the riffraff off the road.
Pretty clearly, it's a regressive tax.
Meanwhile, literally 2 days after that study came out talking about how regressive the tolling on 520 was, we had Richard Conlin, who was the city council member who was the leading advocate for the downtown tunnel, was asked a question about, well, you know, and we've talked about this on this show a number of times, the financing models for tolls on the downtown tunnel just aren't working out. Would you consider tolling I-5 to try and make up the difference? And he literally giggles and says, and holds up a sign saying, maybe. Now this is like in a lightning round.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, you know, the idea of tolling I-5 in order to pay for the downtown tunnel is something that, I suspect nobody wanted to broach until after the election, because it's going to be spectacularly unpopular, and it's a really, really bad idea. Because if people are avoiding 520 in such, aside from the aggressiveness, if people are avoiding 520 in such numbers where there's, you know, the only way around that is 8 miles out of your way, well, surface streets in Seattle, there are any number of ways to get where you're going. It just, you know, takes longer. And what you're asking for is gridlock on already crowded arterials leading into and out of downtown Seattle, and for that matter, just about all the north-south routes through Seattle. I can't imagine what Aurora and the SR-99 south of downtown coming in from West
East
Seattle
Lake
are going to look like.
What they're going to look like.
Yeah, all of that. Be aware that that's on the horizon, and that the people making these decisions seem pretty clueless about how regressive these taxes are, or what the income would be, or what the impact would be.
All right. And then finally, 522.
Yeah. We mentioned that earlier. That's the GMO labeling initiative. And we had a number of additional donations. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. This week, Attorney General Bob Ferguson, Washington State Attorney General, he told the Grocery Manufacturers Association that it needed to reveal the companies behind its $7 million in donations to the anti-522 campaign. And he went ahead and filed suit in Thurston County Superior Court to get them to do so. The Grocery Manufacturers Association responded, well, okay, here you go. Here's the list. And the list is pretty revealing. It's all the same donors who submitted millions of dollars to defeat the California proposition. PepsiCo gave $1.6 million. Coca-Cola gave a little over $1 million. Nestle, a little over $1 million. General Mills, almost $600,000. And then a whole bunch gave about $250,000. Hershey Company, Kellogg Company, ConAgra gave almost $300,000. Campbell Soup gave about $250,000. J.M. Smucker Company, close to $250,000. And then a whole bunch of others gave around $100,000, including Cargill and Company. So, you know, these big these big food manufacturers, big agribusiness companies who have a lot invested in not letting people know what's actually in their processed food.
Yeah, and I found my notes now, which is why I handed off to Maria in the first place, since it was right in front of me and I couldn't find it. Now, this is the same Thurston County Court, I believe, that actually threw out a similar lawsuit from the anti-people
and
a couple weeks ago.
They threw it out saying that the anti-folks couldn't file suit so quickly after raising the issue that only the attorney general could. And so Ferguson turned around and said, okay, I'm going to do it.
But that extra delay of a couple weeks and an election that's coming right up does make a huge difference. And you know what? If this goes down and that money was invested to make it go down, they don't care about having violated the law. They don't care about having to pay a fine, because a fine from one county and one U.S. state to these global corporations means absolutely nothing.
And there's plenty of money in that fund that the Grocery Manufacturers Association collected for this.
And that's not the only place they're spending money on this. They're also spending it on Congress. And so, unfortunately, Congress did not go home when it shut down the rest of government and agreed last Saturday to put the 2013 Farm Bill into conference committee, slipped into that on the House side is a little gift from Tea Party Representative Stephen King from Western Iowa, who has been spewing xenophobia and racism for a number of years. But he's cozy friends with Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland and all those folks. And he put an amendment in that literally would prevent state laws from impacting food and farming, including the state laws requiring labeling of genetically modified organisms. Those are already in law in Connecticut and Maine, and maybe soon in Washington as well. The amendment was intended to block a California law from being implemented. It's already been passed that would require farm animals to be given enough state space to spread their limbs and turn around, so a factory farming law. But the way that it's written also impacts the GMO labeling. It's written very broadly. So
a bad amendment all the way around.
Yeah, and so even if we pass 522, that doesn't mean it will stop being under attack and Congress could easily outlaw it entirely.
Yeah.
All right. Shutdown, economic costs of the shutdown.
Yeah, it's early days yet, but I've seen estimates ranging from $12 to $24 billion just of the immediate costs of the economic shutdown. More importantly is longer-term effects from this partisan bickering in D.C. and Congress's inability to pass any financial bills. A new study by macroeconomic advisors this week showed they're a private nonpartisan group, shows that it's cost the economy almost 1 million jobs since 2010, and that's not counting the current shutdown. In 2013 alone, congressional bickering shaved about 0.3 percentage points off of GDP growth and cut growth by 1% in this quarter alone, if you take into account the current shutdown. Now, the GOP has this myth that any money spent on government is money that you might as well burn because it doesn't do anything for the economy. And I think the current shutdown really proved that that is absolutely not true, that money that is spent on government is actually very efficient in terms of boosting the economy. It provides jobs. Yeah. And it provides the economic support for a lot of communities across the country that rely both on just on tourism to national parks, but also on various other projects that the federal government funds.
Yeah, and can we not call it congressional bickering? Because, you know, in terms of what's different from past years, one party is different, not two parties.
Yeah.
For better or for worse. All right, on to Haiti.
Yeah, there was a new report this week by the Worker Rights Consortium on sweatshops in Haiti. Now, some of these factories that are used to make cheap clothing were built by U.S. development funds after the disaster, the earthquake in Haiti. These sweatshops, it turns out, are depriving their workers of about one-third of their wages by not paying or by not paying overtime or by setting super high piece rate quotas instead of by paying hourly wages. These sweatshops are cheating their workers. Some of the clothing that are made in these sweatshops are clothing you can buy at Gap, Target, and Walmart. Now, in April, a separate report by Better Work found widespread wage violations in all 24 clothing factories in Haiti. So this is not a new problem. It's been going on for a while. The minimum wage for clothing workers is $6.90 per day, not per hour, per day. But most workers in Haiti are paid only $4.60 per day, and that's not enough to live on.
Now, how much of that came out of the aid that was supposed to go in after the earthquake a few years ago?
I don't know the actual number, but I know quite a bit of it was used to build the factory shells for these companies to go in and employ workers. So I would guess it's in the millions.
All right. Events.
Several coming up this week. On Wednesday night, the 23rd, Wild Children Domesticated Dreams with anthropologist and green anarchist Leila Abdel Rahim on civilization and the birth of formal education. That'll be at the Black Coffee Co-op at 501 East Pine Street on Capitol Hill at 7 o'clock next Wednesday. At 7:30 on Wednesday, Sightline is sponsoring San Antonio Mayor and rising Democratic star Julian Castro coming into Town Hall to talk on sustainable cities and what it takes to achieve them. Aside from, you know, enriching Paul Allen. $5, it'll be at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca in downtown Seattle. And then on Thursday the 24th, the Common Good Cafe Thursday night series continues. This coming week, it'll be John DeGraff, author of Take Back Your Time. He's got a new book, Happiness, Time, Sustainability, Lessons from Bhutan. That'll be at the Common Good Cafe at United Temple University Methodist Church, 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District.
All right. And I believe Elliot Adams, the president or former president of Veterans for Peace, is going to be speaking also at Common Good Cafe on Friday at 7 p.m.
That wasn't on their website as of this morning.
We're going on my memory there, so
okay.
Take that with a large grain of salt.
Okay.
All right. Actually, that might be the following. No, that is the coming Friday. That is coming Friday.
Well, check their website.
All right.
Or Facebook page.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, that is the following week. Never mind.
No wonder I didn't see it.
All right. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. And hopefully by the end of the weekend, we will have the recommendations for the fall ballot coming up. And you can take a look through those, both the ballot initiatives that we went through this week and the elected officials that we'll go through next week.
All right. Elliot Adams, a week from Friday.
Thank you.